You are listening to the Launch Over podcast on the Without Your Head Network. Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of the Launch Over podcast. I'm Sophia Cassiola.
And I am Michael J. Epstein.
Today we have a very esteemed guest.
King Ghidorah the dog. Oh, wait, no, that's not who our esteemed guest is.
Also him.
We also have King Ghidorah the dog here on our couch. He's our silent partner.
Wow. But silent is
he's
to
not
be
that
seen.
Silent. But our very special guest is our good friend, Catherine Capozzi. Hello.
Hey. Hi, everybody.
And we've worked with Catherine on countless projects.
Hundreds.
I've lost count anyway.
Yep.
But before we talk to you about all the many things that we've been working on together, we like to get the show started by talking about what we've been watching.
Yes.
And you're in for a bad time this week, Catherine, because almost everything we've been watching is festival films that are not even available to anyone mostly.
Okay, so
you haven't seen any of them, probably.
I haven't seen any of them.
But
no.
you can tell us what you whether you would potentially like them if you
Okay, I'll tell you that. That I can tell you. I'll give you that. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
But we've been watching films from Fantastic Fest, Twisted Dreams. And we're just starting up with Nightstream right now. I think those are the big ones that have come in recent times.
Yeah, well, usually this time of year, we are traveling to a lot of film festivals because for whatever reason, people seem to think October is the horror month. I think horror is all year round. But a lot of festivals get all jammed up into October and we end up being on the road a lot. So that's one nice thing is we're home watching a bunch of awesome festival movies.
So what have we been watching?
I guess let's start with House. House, where was it from?
Like House Madrid? Was from Twisted Dreams. Oh, where was it?
Yeah.
Where was it from? It was from Spain.
Yeah, it was at Twisted Dreams. I really liked it. It's
first of all, it's called House
with a zero
and a three. It definitely spoke to me. It was about an hour of 8 people sitting at a table talking about internet jargon and terminology, and then a half hour of like a weird mystery about whether there's some kind of crazy event going on or not. It's a super like sci-fi thing, very closely tied to reality in the sense of like the technology.
Right, like they talk about WikiLeaks and that's a big portion of the plot is like files that WikiLeaks has disseminated into the world as like a safeguard for themselves. So there's like files you can download that you don't have the password. It's very encrypted and nobody has unencrypted them. But basically if whoever gets arrested or taken over, like the password will just go out online and then everybody will have access to this. So it's about like this guy who has decrypted these files and what's in it.
And there's something very, you know, important in the files basically.
Right.
I would have probably hated it if it were in English because it's very on the nose with like, it almost feels like you're reading a Wired article. It's yeah. Like here's what the dark net is, and here's what WikiLeaks is, and here's what hacking is.
I mean, I was talking to Michael about it during the movie. Is like a lot of it was so basic that I was like angry at it a little bit because I was like, I know all this stuff, but then if it was any deeper than it was, I would have been totally lost. So it was like kind of just the right amount for me of like the internet jargon.
I saw reviews on Letterboxd that were basically saying like it was too complex for them to understand and
right.
follow.
Okay, so that's like, you know, it was interesting and it was hard sci-fi. And we watched the Q&A with the director and it was his first film. I think he did a great job with it. And it was definitely, you know, it was a new way of approaching sci-fi with technology that I haven't seen done before. And I really appreciated that. And it was very smartly made for being 8 people in a house.
And it had a really cool ending that we won't spoil, but that we, for a second, we were like, this movie sucks. The ending is terrible. And then we're like, wait a second. Did we misunderstand what happened? And then we realized, we thought about it more and we're like, oh no, we just misunderstood what happened at the end. And the ending actually is cool.
I could have used another 30 seconds.
Yeah.
One more line of dialogue and I would have totally not missed the ending ever.
Well, we got it figured out.
And we did.
So anyway, I don't know when that's coming out. It's been on the festival circuit for a bit, but I don't know when it's actually going to be released, but definitely check it out when it does. House with a 0 and a 3.
So we also saw Dinner in America, which we saw at Fantastic Fest, but I think it was at Fantasia as well. And it's currently at Nightstream, which is going on right now.
Yeah. So if you're in the US, you can watch this movie, not right now, but this week, sometime this week it comes out.
This movie managed to surprise me because I was on edge for the first half of the movie that I was going to be very offended by it. But it's just a quirky, I guess, dark comedy about this young kids One's in like a punk band, but he's like out of juvie or prison. And the other one is a very awkward young woman and their relationship. But it kind of turns into like they're writing punk songs together and going to punk shows. And like the song they write together was so charming. I really loved it. So that was surprising to me.
It's like, it feels like a early 90s, like indie romance movie that was made now, was made now for some reason.
Yeah, so it was pretty cute. By the end, I was sold on it.
And Pat Healy, who was in Half Cocked that we made, that Catherine, you worked on as well. Yeah. He plays the father.
Stuffy father of the girl.
And he's really funny.
He's very funny. Yeah. There's a lot of funny dinner scenes. And there's a song in the movie called Dinner in America. And they juxtapose like the screwed up rich punk kid and his family dinner and like her dinner with like her kind of religious stuffy parents. And so it's just quirky, fun little movie, but it's definitely hitting all the fests right now.
Yeah. And I think it's going to speak to all the people who are into the kind of offbeat stuff. We said it's not really like Napoleon Dynamite, but
it's
definitely has that family Greasy Strangler, which I prefer Greasy Strangler over Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah.
But in that family of quirky, weird, like offbeat, almost surrealist characters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a charming movie. It's a very feel good, charming movie with a lot of irreverence in it.
Yeah. And it's not the type of movie I particularly usually like, but it worked on me.
Yep.
So the next movie is like a very heady movie that we saw at the Charlotte International Film Festival, and it was called Me and Me, and it's a Korean movie. I believe, was this also his first, it was an actor whose first film, I think?
I think it was his first directing, first time directing, and I don't even know how to describe this movie.
It's so hard to describe because it's very kind of based in dreams and then who you are at particular moments, and people are kind of switching places, but super fascinating movie. And it kind of switches gears like two or three times in the film as far as like even what characters you're following. But we were very wrapped the whole time. And I don't know that it ever quite answered the things that I wanted it to answer, but that I don't know that that's a fault of the movie. I think it's just me wanting answers.
Yeah. The opening premise is that I think this is only really the first 10 minutes, and I think it gives a hook for it. But the opening premise is that there's a guy who moves to a kind of a small suburb of Seoul to be a teacher
school at the most.
And so he's in this town, and the town is kind of busybody, so everybody sort of knows each other. And it turns out that his wife every night becomes possessed by someone. And it's like a different person every night. And they're, I guess, real people. I mean,
well, they also have a super cute, like, it sounds scary, but they have a cute love story with it where he just interacts with whoever it is. And so like one night it's like a comedian and he's telling jokes with a comedian. Another night it's like a wrestler and they're like wrestling on the floor. And so like he just really loves her, like despite this like weird disability of being possessed by somebody every night. And like in one scene it's his own mother and he has like a heart to heart with his mother. Like, so it's super weird and cute. And
right. So that's the setup. And then the town finds out about it and they're not really so tolerant of it. And then things go wrong from there.
And then it follows like a detective trying to figure out what happened.
And it all kind of wraps around itself. And I would say that I couldn't tell you what actually, like, exactly. It's not really a narrative film. We should say it that way. It becomes an abstract, you know, metaphorical discussion about identity and about some other stuff.
Fractured identities. I don't know. But it was really cool. And it definitely kept me very engaged the whole time. And it's just a very fascinating movie. Very deep, I think, in a way that is kind of unusual.
So, again, no idea when that will be out, but...
Yeah, but Me and Me. It was really neat.
Then we also saw at Fantastic, we saw a film called Laughter.
And yeah, mixed feelings about Laughter. It's a Montreal.
It was Canadian, right?
Montreal. Yeah. It's French.
It's French-Canadian, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
It's a weird one because it's this woman who, in the beginning, there's a civil war in whatever, you know, the world of the film. And she is part of a group of people who are basically like genocided, essentially. But she somehow survives. And then it takes place some years, I don't know if it was 10 years later
something like that.
So most of the movie's 10 years after. You see the events of that, and they're pretty disturbing. It's really, you know, it's graphically displayed.
Yeah.
But 10 years later, it's about her trying to cope with returning to, you know, whatever one would consider a normal life in that context.
It tried to deal with a lot. I mean, it tried to deal with survivor's guilt and like, because her boyfriend died and she lived in this situation. And now she has a new life where she's like a nurse. She has a new boyfriend. And so like, you know, I think kind of feels guilty for like this kind of good life that she has. And then, you know, she sees somebody from the past and it kind of brings it all back. And it's like a little melodramatic at times, I think, in like a manipulative way for the audience, but also like it was really well done too. So,
and it's kind of it's torn between being a comedy and a serious film. And there are all these scenes where they're just, like you're saying, it's very theatrical, melodramatic in the sense that they sit down and have like monologues almost, or like dialogues that are very much feel like you're inside of a play at that point. It's not like, there are moments that don't, that feel very artificial, and then there are moments that feel very grounded. So it's a strange mix of things.
But. Well, she does like a stand-up comedy routine in like a fake environment, I think, like inside of her mirror, but there's an audience, and kind of playing with like the dark humor of like this, her situation. And she has like a really nice relationship with, she works at like the old folks home with an older woman. And then it also played with like a little bit like Me and Me, like who are the characters, because they do kind of blend together. Like at times I was like, is she the old woman also? Like, so there's definitely like,
there's a lot of metaphor.
Also probably benefited from being in French, I'd say. As far as handling like
that
a lot of this
so French,
dreaminess.
Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that definitely.
But it was definitely reaching to
it
discuss
was neat.
Topics. Yeah, it was interesting.
It's hard to say if I loved it, but I thought it was neat. It was definitely worth watching. So that's called Laughter. It has a French title that I think means something close to laughter, but not quite. Like maybe the laugh. I don't know how you say the laugh in la rira or something like that.
I don't know.
Remember. Anyway,
Catherine.
Don't know French, but
Rigolo. Yeah, don't. Oh, I don't know French either. Yeah. I only toured there for 20 years.
But. Yeah. But let's turn things a little bit. I also at Fantastic Fest saw a movie called Triple Fisher. And what that is a mashup of the three TV films that were made about Amy Fisher, Joey Buttafuoco, Mary Jo Buttafuoco situation in the early 90s. This kind of like film mashup artist took the three films that star three different actors as Amy Fisher. And
it's like Alyssa Milano and Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, and then another woman.
Kind of a more unknown actress.
Yeah, and they sort of contrast the different scenes. So they show a lot of the scenes, they'll show like the same events, but mix up. Like, so it'll be like one Amy Fisher, and then it cuts to a different Joey Buttafuoco, or it'll show like multiple reactions of Amy Fisher, of the various Amy Fishers. In the thing.
Wow.
And I thought this would be something I didn't want to watch, but then it turned out to be pretty interesting, I thought. Partly because those events are so seared in the memory of anybody who was, you know, of having a memory at that time. It was such a big event. And I grew up on Long Island, so, you know, a half hour away from where it all went down. So that was an interesting one. I don't think it's available anywhere, but they're talking about doing a theatrical run of it.
Well, I wonder if they can't release it.
I think they're just doing it. Yeah.
One interesting thing in the Q&A, because I didn't actually watch the movie, but I caught the Q&A, was he was talking about how each of the movies kind of focused on different parts of the story and different events. And he was kind of trying to reconstruct the entire story by using like this one focused more on the lawyers, or this one focused more on the press, and like kind of tried to weave it to be most accurate to the story.
Everybody was fighting for the rights because they all wanted to like get the actual official rights when this was happening. So one network, I don't remember, you know, which got which, but one network got Amy Fisher's story, like her official story. One network got I guess it was Joey Buttafuoco or the family, you know, story. And then another network got the press story, the main press investigator, the guy who wrote the big article about it. So it was basically like those three, like Sophia's saying, it was those three aspects.
Oh, wow.
But not just from an outsider point of view. It was actually like interacting with an individual or perspective directly tied to the case. So that's why it was those three angles. It was an interesting movie. And the guy does a lot of this kind of art, weird collage mashup art. And I guess he's doing a film now that's supposed to come out next year called 48 Hours Literally, which is the movie 48 Hours, but stretched out to a full 48 hours.
Is it Liam Neeson in that movie?
No, it's Nick Nolte.
Yeah, but they're talking about having him sleep for 8 hours at a time.
Yeah, because apparently there's a scene with Nick Nolte like sleeping in one moment. Yeah. And maybe it's like 10 seconds in the movie, but he was talking about looping it for 8 hours. So it's like, you know, the actual 48 hours of his life. So when he goes to sleep, you just sit and watch, you know, very Warhol-esque kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I'll look forward to spending 48 hours watching that movie when it comes out.
My God.
And they're talking about trying to find theaters to show it, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. But it's pretty interesting. Anyway, so you know the blending between art and film. I love that kind of stuff. We also saw the semi-documentary.
Possibly mockumentary. Michael and I were talking about how we've ended up making a lot of mockumentaries of recent times, so it's kind of fun to see. You Cannot Kill David Arquette. And definitely based in reality, this documentary, but definitely also felt a little scripted at times.
For anybody who doesn't know David Arquette, I'm assuming you know who David Arquette is, but he... At some point in the
like 2000,
early
maybe?
Right around 2000, he ended up as the world heavyweight wrestling champion through like some weird, you know, scripted thing where he just kind of like showed up and like won a match. And then he didn't really wrestle much, let's just say.
Yeah, and fans hated it.
And everybody was really pissed off about it. So then David Arquette now, who's trying to find, you know, find peace with the fact that he never quite had the success maybe he should have. And he never, you know, he's never been taken as seriously as maybe he wanted to be taken. So he decided he was going to go back to wrestling and actually like legitimately train and learn how to wrestle and then go through and
like, there's a scene where he ends up in like a backyard wrestling match with like some townies, like six townies, and that's like all that's there. And like the mat breaks and he's trying to do magic tricks. And it's just like, it's so hilarious and weird.
I think a lot of it is probably staged.
Yeah. But that probably is an aspect of the culture too, though.
Right. So the film, I think it's a really interesting film.
It's fascinating.
It's a little sloppy and messy, and it's not clear like what it's trying to do, but it's a fun watch.
He's just kind of a fun guy to watch. You know, he's just kind of a captivating dude.
Yeah, and I think it has like some heart in it, and it feels good. I mean, our friend Neil, who you know, Neil Jones, who we interviewed on the first episode, and who runs the Without Your Head Network. He hated this movie. He's a big wrestling fan. He does a wrestling podcast and everything.
So we're gonna get kicked off the Without Your Head Network for saying like we enjoyed this movie.
He said you're not allowed to say you liked You Cannot. Yeah. No, he hated it. I think because he's so embedded in wrestling, and so he
and
felt
the reality
like
of wrestling
weirdness about it. But I thought like the fact that it was a blend of reality and non-reality and staging is actually the perfect kind of thing for talking about wrestling, because really wrestling is essentially like theatrics and staging, but it also involves a lot of real skill and talent. It's not like, you know, it's fake in a way, but it's not like special effects fake, right? I mean, somebody has to jump off the top rope and land correctly, and somebody has to, you know, be able to flip someone correctly and all that kind of stuff, even if they plan it, even if it's choreographed.
So Cinematic Void, which is a screening series that happens through the American Cinematheque at the Egyptian and the Aero Theater in LA, we were like religious. We would go to everyone we possibly could because they always showed really weird, interesting movies, and it was just always a lot of fun. So since the pandemic, they've been doing like live-ish YouTube Cinematic Voids with like commercial breaks, and you know, they stop and chat about the movie, and they've mostly been finding like weirder, harder to find movies, and a lot of TV movies that they're just really hard to get. So it's been really fun few months of Friday nights with the Cinematic Void. So this week they showed Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, which was a TV like kind of Halloween time movie in the 80s, kind of a little brutal for a TV movie, I think.
It's about a guy who is, I guess you would say, developmentally disabled guy who's friends with a kid. He's like an adult, basically like a 30-year-old guy who has the sort of mental capacities of a young child, essentially. And the townspeople hate him and like think he's going to do something bad. So they end up murdering him, which, spoiler, but it's very obvious in the setup for the movie. So he kind of comes back. It's not actually clear what happens, but the premise is that he kind of comes back and gets revenge. So it's like a slasher film.
But he comes back as a scarecrow.
And basically kills all the people responsible for his death. And it was really, I really liked it a lot. The guy is played by Larry Drake, who plays Dr. Giggles, and he plays the villain in Darkman and a bunch of other, he's in a bunch of other horror movies. I thought it was a really cool movie. I was surprised because for TV movies, like Sophia was saying, you expect kind of a tameness to it. Mm-hmm. And this was like some serious...
Even like, because he had befriended this little girl and even she's like a little creepy about, you know, like she's kind of cheering on the murders and stuff, which I thought was really funny, especially...
That's so creep.
You know.
It was some cool stuff.
Yeah.
I think that might be coming out on Blu-ray at some point soon. But it's definitely worth checking out if you get a chance to see it, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. And I guess I had read that it was produced as an independent film for general release and then picked up as a TV movie. So I don't think anybody greenlit it initially as
a TV
movie.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, but it did end up coming out as a TV movie. And it is, they kind of cut away. So like a guy gets thrown into a, I don't know what you call it, a combine, like a grinder, like a farm grinder or whatever. And they do cut away before you see him like actually mutilated. But it's, you know, you feel it in there. Like it's pretty rough. Like there's some rough stuff in there. But I liked that a lot. I thought it was a really, really fun movie.
All right, last movie we're going to talk about this week. And like definitely we watched more. So if you want to follow us on Letterboxd, you can really see the nitty gritty of everything we saw. But the last one to talk about for now was a movie I just kind of ran across on Amazon Prime. And it just kept catching my eye. And finally I was like, I just got to watch this movie. So it's called Born of Fire. And the description is like a master flautist, which already I'm sold. It's a movie about a flute player. And an astronaut. She works for NASA, right?
Astronomer.
Astronomer, yes. So this flautist and this astronomer like meet and go to Turkey to like fight the master musician in Turkey who's also like a flautist. So there's all this flute playing going on. Which speaking of score, it's a fascinating score because of all the flute. So, you know, Michael That's and cool. I used to play in a band that Catherine was sometimes involved with called the Michael J. Epstein Memorial Library. And we had a flute player and... You know, so we have this joke because somebody at one point at one of our shows yelled that they were hot for flute and it just kind of stuck. And so I was like, this movie is like literally hot for flute.
It's an entire surrealist horror movie about becoming a master flute player.
So, yeah. And so it was a Pakistani / London born filmmaker. I think it was a British movie ultimately. And the cast is British, but super fascinating because they go to like the desert. And, you know, just kind of like meet their history and they fight off this flautist. It's all super arty and just very beautiful because like the vista of like the white sand and then there's like waterfalls happening and just total weirdness. Just very much like a surrealist art movie.
Yeah, it feels like a Jodorowsky movie almost or something along those lines.
In that vein.
It has a lot of Islamic mythology in it too because the guy's a jinn. Yeah. And so it's kind of like maybe one of few Islamic horror movies that I've seen. And I wouldn't say
this is in the 80s this came out. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's directly tied to any specific, you know, Islamic tradition or anything like that, but within the context of it, that general mythology. The guy who is the lead, this guy Peter Firth, is the lead in the movie Equus, which is like one of my favorite movies as well. So
definitely, like if you're into weird surrealist art films, it's very cool, very strange film. I recommend it.
Yeah.
Really beautiful, beautiful visuals.
Especially for if you're into magic flutes.
And if you're into flautists.
That sounds good. That sounds good.
If you're hot for flute,
I sent it to our old flute player, Rachel Blumenthal. And I was like, you have to watch this movie.
And she never talked to us again.
Yeah, she hasn't spoken to me since. Who knows?
So, Catherine, have you been watching anything that you wanted to add as well? Or
I've been watching like Netflix stuff right now, like just series. So what have I been watching? We watched Away with Hilary Swank, which sci-fi, I don't know. I was just like, well, maybe I'll check this out, see what it is. And here's the thing. What I'm liking about some of the things I've watched, and I think there was the movie, or Netflix, I think, had the same thing about Messiah, about the Jesus figure. Was he Jesus? Was he Satan? Did you guys hear about that?
No.
We're not up to date on Netflix information. So,
well, I mean, yeah. I've been watching some of that stuff. But cool. What I've been liking about these films is that they've been having like a lot of original, if they have like a Chinese character, they're speaking in Chinese. If they're speaking in Russian, they're speaking in Russian and they're overdubbing the English, the subtitles. So I think, I mean, what I like about that is like you're getting like the tonality of what's actually happening instead of having everything be badly dubbed in English,
right.
Which I think Blood of the Tribbids, right? You guys, you did that with French, right? We had French and then we had the English subtitle. So I think I've been appreciating that, you know, for...
I've never been able to really articulate it, but there is definitely something about the experience. We watch a lot of foreign films. And we watch a lot of American films as well. But there's something about the experience of watching a film in a language that you don't understand and mm-hmm. reading subtitles that's very different than, you know, being able to understand the dialogue as it's happening. And I can't really articulate why that's special, but in certain cases, especially in the kind of dreamy, weird stuff, it really works for me, or it changes my experience in a way that is very positive. And I think for Blood of the Tribbids, we really wanted to capture the feeling of like a Jean Roland movie, which to me, a big part of that is not being able to understand the dialogue or feeling like the dialogue is coming from another place, like a magic place, which is mm-hmm. France, I guess. But a place that I can't, you know, directly connect to and that I have to be like detached from and then read along with.
I think that's also what we were kind of saying earlier too about some of the films we've been watching recently is like they work better for us in another language because they're like dealing with like these kind of dreamier concepts or kind of more cerebral concepts. It's just like something like you were saying, like it detaches us, but also like makes us maybe pay even more attention because we're like reading it and we're like kind of so focused.
I mean, when you're listening to, a lot of different foreign languages, you know, having traveled a lot, when I'm in different places, like when you hear people speak in their native tongue, it's true. It's almost like you're walking through the dream state because you don't know what they're saying. Mm-hmm. But especially like, you know, when you're in, especially like an Asian country where it's such a tonal language, you can't understand anything, and how they deliver that, you know, how they deliver, you know, how they speak the emotion behind the tone. It's very like, it's musical.
I find a lot of expressiveness, even when I don't understand the language, of course, there's so much expressiveness in the way that the people speak and in their interaction with the sound of it. I guess, I mean, mm-hmm. it's almost like, it's like music in a way, really. It's like score in a way,
yeah.
Right?
There's
something that you connect with. And again, I can't articulate the exact thing, and I'm sure somebody has some kind of scientific theory that could explain this, mm-hmm. but there's something about even when it's a language that is a very different prosody or cadence or something about it, like an Asian language that's not really similar in terms of tonality, yeah. in terms of grammatic structure or anything. There's still something about the way that that auditory cueing affects my perception of what the emotion is in the moment. And it really works. I mean, that's one of the things I love about foreign language mm-hmm. movies. And I've tried to watch movies, you know, I've turned the sound down because maybe Sophia's sleeping and I'm like, oh, I'll just watch with the subtitles, but turn the sound down and kind of miss the dialogue. And like, it ruins it.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't have the same effect, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's also funny because I remember like when I was going back and forth to France a lot and I'd watch, you know, go to the theater there. So a lot of it was American films. But then there would be section. I remember this one movie, there was a whole section that was in French and I was sitting there. I'm like, where are the subtitles? Right. And they're like, why? And then I was like, oh, I'm in France. There's not going to be subtitles.
Right.
That's why I was like asking, what are they saying? You know, there's like 5 minutes of dialogue and the translation was, they just said no. And I was like, that's bullshit. I know that's not what they said.
Well, that's another interesting thing is like when you're looking at subtitles, because I know a little bit of German, for example. So when I watch a German movie, it's not that I can necessarily understand everything, but I can understand some of the dialogue. And then you see the discrepancy between like the words that are on the screen and and what's being said. And I think, you know, it's a weird balance of trying to capture the emotion of it and the meaning of it without, you know, without ruining that, but also like not ruining the poetry of the language and the specific word choices and the subtleties of it. Yeah. And you can't, it's just an impossible thing to really do completely. I mean, it's why there are so many, you know, any great book that's been translated, there are probably many, many different translations and people have their favorite one, you know, because there are different approaches,
very different
approaches to translating. And so
that is true.
Yeah.
That
foreign, is true. Foreign language films, I think are really, it's really a shame that people are scared to watch. With so subtitles. Many people are scared to watch it with subtitles in foreign language films. But
right, I agree. And that's, once again, that's why I like some of the things I've been watching, you know, on Netflix that have had, you know, the you know, multiple characters from all different countries. They're not just having the whole scene in English. They're kind of like cutting to, you know, Russian or Chinese or, you know, whatever language, French. And it does make a difference. It's kind of, it is cool because you're like, okay, that is what would happen in real life. If you were in the room, you're like, I don't know what they're saying. They're speaking Russian. I have no idea what's going on, you know?
It's also like, it's nice that that is changing because I think for a long period, especially in sci-fi films, it's like so many were made in England. And so like all, it's the future and everybody has a British accent. And it's just like, it kind of takes me out of it sometimes. I'm just like, why is everybody British in this universe?
Well, that's the Star Wars, right? Everybody's British in space.
I mean, that's the biggest example, but there's so many films like that. Or like in dubs, like there's like, you know, so many movies were dubbed by British people. You know, it's just like the voice doesn't match what we're seeing, and it doesn't match the humanity of it either.
That you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, and capturing the performance is very difficult in a dub.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we watch a lot of Italian films, especially giallo films.
Some of them are great, the dubs.
Yeah.
Some of them are great. There's a couple like voices I hear a lot in some of those 70s Italian films, where it's like the same guy or the same woman, and I'm like, oh yeah, it's them.
It's true, right? They've got the voiceover, right? The same ones. That's what when I was in France a lot, they would have like the you know, the stuff that I can only tell anything that was in English when they were overdubbing. It was always the same, you know, two act, you know, French male, French woman, you know. So it was kind of like
sometimes the funniest thing was watching it, and sometimes they're really good.
Yeah, sometimes they don't. Like Star Wars was in French. I was there, and it was on TV, and it's like, you know, you hear like the Darth Vader characters like Luke, je suis papa, you know, like what? That's the line you want to hear, but it's like, it kind of loses. Long. It's, you know, and like, well, okay. All right. It sounds so nice when you say it in French, you know, I don't know.
He's not as upset about it.
Right.
No.
They're just like, well, let's take a little
let's have some wine and cheese and some baguette.
Anyway, so those are the movies we've been watching. I think that's what we've been doing this week, right?
Yeah. And so right now we're attending, I think we mentioned Nightstream, which is a conglomerate film festival of Boston Underground Film Festival, Brooklyn Horror, North Bend, The Overlook, and Popcorn Frights all kind of came together to present Nightstream, which, you know, so far just started today, but we're looking forward to watching a bunch with that.
We already got to see the New England block called Dunwich Horrors that contains a film that Catherine, you might be familiar with called Shiny Diamonds.
Oh, yeah.
So we're back here with our good friend Catherine Capozzi, who we have collaborated with on countless films in a number of different ways, but primarily we've worked with you on doing scoring and music. And you've actually participated in scoring all of our feature films up to this point. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And many, many shorts.
Yes. And even when we are not the directors, but if we have a hand in the short, we still try to get Catherine on board.
And I say yes, yes, yes.
And so we have a number of films that we could talk about. What we've actually been working this week together on a film. This is a perfect timing. King Ghidorah the dog is getting really fussy right now. Yeah. And it's perfect timing to say that we've been working together on a film this week that stars King Ghidorah the dog. It's his first appearance in film.
That we know of. Could have had a whole career before he found us.
But we don't know because he's he's something like 9 years old. So we don't know what his life was like before. But we'll call it his film debut.
Introducing King Ghidorah. Yes.
And this is a film directed by Sophia.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about it?
Sure. Well, I made it kind of instigated by a film festival. So Mondo Cult, which is also had a film screening night at the Egyptian that we also really like to go to because they really found like very bizarre films and kind of offbeat and like not just horror, but like just weird genre film. So they decided to do like a little competition for quarantine, basically, of movies that have to star your pet. I was excited to do that because, you know, I've been filming King Ghidorah a lot anyway. And so it's a horror movie starring King Ghidorah as Dracula, and it's called Bloodhound. And of course, I waited to the absolute last minute to finish this film. So it was a big rush. to get it done. It all came together, 3.5 minutes of entertainment starring King Ghidorah. So hopefully that will be out this month and for at least some sort of viewing. And then, you know, go to some other festivals with it too. But that was what we worked on this month. And, you know, it was just like running around following him in his Dracula cape.
And one of the great things about this film, Bloodhound, is we had the opportunity to collaborate with Catherine.
Yes, and yeah. I gave you like 2 hours to do the music for it.
Pretty much. I was like, and I was coming back from Connecticut, like dealing with a whole bunch of stuff there. But anyway, I was up till 5 a.m.
Oh my God.
You know, King G was awesome in his first
role. He's a very good actor.
Yeah.
He's a good actor. So
we actually did get him to do, I mean, like through the power of treats, we did get him to do some interesting things.
You'd be surprised how much treats can
yeah.
accomplish.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But
he's
no,
got a new career.
It was really fun one to do. We have a number of films that are on the festival circuit right now that we've worked on with you, mm-hmm. including Shiny Diamonds, which I had mentioned earlier.
Yeah, which is currently at Nightstream in the Dunwich Horror Block, Shiny Diamonds. And next week it'll be at Nightmares, which is also doing they're calling it The Masquerade. It's the Nightmares Film Festival is doing their online program. So that's pretty exciting. And it has a very cool synth score.
Yep.
That we got to work on together. Yeah. So one of the things that we've had fun doing, I think, is we worked in a variety of styles together. I don't know if you want to talk about some of the different things. Like we put you through the ringer on this, right? Because we started, you know, doing 10. That was like a 70s movie.
A lot of guitar.
Yeah.
Shiny Diamonds and Magnetic were a little more like 80s synthy.
Blood of the Tribbers is just like straight up orchestral, right?
Yeah, it's like 70s.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, string quartet, I guess I would say more than
String quartet. And that's when I first got my brand new nylon string guitar, which we used. That was the first time it was ever recorded with that, actually. So that was cool. There's been a variety of, learning by putting your feet into the fire, I guess, or over the fire. I don't know what it is, over the fire. So it's been like, it's cool because to me, it's like my big dream was always, first was be in a band, release a CD. Then it was like movies. I would like to do movies in some way, you know, because when I was younger, I used to actually play at making scripts and writing movies and scripts and things like that, which no one will ever see no one will ever see those. But working, especially together with you guys, it's awesome because like you said, 10 was the 70s, you know, so we talked about having different themes for each of the characters and in depth, like, you know, what would be some of the cool things for the historian or the model or the rebel, the renegade. And, each one of those had very unique themes. So that was like, that was more guitar based. I felt like that was like, you know, like kind of the beginning of everything with some weird stuff. Cause I know, you know, Mike will always take stuff and twist it a little bit more, which was cool.
Right.
As moving on to like, you know, Magnetic and all the other stuff that we did, it was definitely like synth based. Cause I remember it's like, I was always like, I need to have my guitar to write some of the first lines. And you were like, no, you
no
have
guitar.
To use the keyboard. And I was like, cause I mean, it's true. Each thing that you work with, you will play differently, you know?
That's
so
right. Yeah.
I was like, okay, great. We'll do that.
And I think we've come to you cause we're very motif driven. I would say maybe I listen to too much like late Beethoven music or something, but we're very motif driven and we really feel like, well, there's so many different approaches. Maybe you can talk about your thoughts, but there's so many different approaches to film scoring. And I actually watched earlier today the Miskatonic Bernard Herrmann lecture, which I think was really interesting. It was a little bit about the history of Bernard Herrmann's career and his approach to scoring. And I found it really fascinating because it talked a lot about how his philosophy was really trying to get into the psychological experience of the character who, you know, was being addressed with whatever music was happening at the time. And so, you know, I thought that was a really good way to put it because we really are always interested in the motifs, like tying into the character or the feel or the mood or the thing that we're trying, this part of the story we're trying to tell. And 10 was a fun example. So the movie 10 was a film that we made that's a little bit like a Agatha Christie movie, but all the like the 10 Little Indians Agatha Christie story, but the 10 characters in it are all have very specific archetypes. And so we wanted to bring you in to help really enhance that. We're like, we want to really push this idea that these people are really, really like tied to these stereotypes. So like mm-hmm. really artificially. And so we asked you to create themes for each one of them that were unique and really, again, like almost heavy-handed, like over the top, like play a song that represents this thing.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about Peter and the Wolf at the time, right? Because of the...
We did. Yeah. We did. We talked about that. I think the... but also we talked about a variety of different things that were like incorporated. I think the French anthem was one, or the Marseille March, I think, for the historian. I remember that for some reason. But there were like all these different... There's like heavy themes that were kind of like, okay, this would work, you know, for this. Or the co-ed was more like maybe like a Beatlesque kind of thing a little bit. There's different things that, but still had the voice of the film. It wasn't,
right.
It wasn't so, you know, different that you're like, what the hell? Now you get like, French horns for this. And, you know, it wasn't like that. It was kind of like, so I think that was part of what made it work was that there was like this musical motif that kind of like stayed, the instrumentation was kind of stayed similar, but what was done was like either adding different things along, you know, keeping it like, you know, guitar centered in some places,
right,
but then adding these different things. So I think there was a voice that came through with 10 with the whole score, and that was, you know, that was a big first thing to do. And I think that's especially since the plot had so many different characters, and even though it was Agatha Christie kind of like in some ways, it was like, I think it worked to tie things together in that way. So,
right.
And also speaking of Bernard Herrmann, I mean, I know that when we did that, I studied a little bit of how he did the Psycho film and how he pieced together the stabs. And,
kind of recreated that scene in the movie with My Death.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And then, and also like, you know, because of, the stabs in that scene, but also some others, we wanted to have like a unique killing sound. Mm-hmm. And so I remember going, okay, well, he listened to birds, you know, and right. I know we had pigs in the film. So I was like, I'm going to listen to pigs. And at first I was like, I'm going to listen to pigs. And then I was like, you know, I actually did go far to listen to like, okay, I'm going to listen to like a slaughterhouse. Ooh. And I couldn't do it. I was like, nah,
the screaming.
That's like, it was like too sad. So I was like, let's listen to like creaky, rusty, sounds of like a door opening, and that with like, frogs and some other like weird sounds to create. And then we layered like different notes on top of those like sounds that I think that was like one of the first things. So that was kind of like a cool,
right,
you know, little unique motif for that particular thing, you know, that was a sound that was for that. So,
yeah, and we really carry that motif thing pretty far. Like the most recent feature that we did together, Clickbait, part of it is sort of a mystery, I guess, is the idea that it's a mystery of who the stalker is. And so the stalker has a theme song, and then each character, it's a little more subtle than what we did with 10. So it's not quite as heavy handed, but each character kind of has their own theme in their parts. And then we would do like blends of the stalker theme and the character themes to make the audience feel like we're hinting at the idea. You know, we're trying to like brainwash you into being fooled into thinking like, oh, this character must be the stalker, because I'm hearing, even if you're not aware of it, that just the subconscious experience of like hearing the music and the notes and the runs of those notes make you start to suspect that character. And so we're toying with the psychological experience that beyond just like what is going on in the head of the character. It's kind of the opposite of the Herrmann thing in a way, because we're not conveying what's going on with the character. We're trying to manipulate the experience of the audience, or the view of the audience. So,
which is, I think for me, it's like, you know, I love working with you guys, obviously, but it's also like being able to like talk about like these different approaches. Cause like you said, each one of the films kind of had like, each of these films have a different approach to what the score is going to be and how it's going to affect the film and the characters in the film. Like in Tribbids, you know, when we're creating like the tension for certain things, it was almost like, you know, how building up the tension, especially before somebody got killed or whatever, or got, you know, arrowed, you know, it's like, so those were kind of like different. It was a different thing. Whereas in Clickbait, you know, building that stalking, like built on the heartbeat, you know, that was like what you had first, you know, said you wanted to have everything kind of like be around like the, you know, a beating heart, you know, like that was the thing that the, some of the sounds were based on, or some of the motifs. So.
Yeah, we try to tie it into the themes of the movie. That's, I mean, that's a great example where Clickbait has a very, very specific heart theme. It opens actually with a waveform from like an EKG. And I guess, you know, spoiler, it ends with a heart
being ripped out of
somebody's body.
Yeah.
So it really is tied. We very, very specifically wanted to look at hearts in terms of their use in social media, like you heart posts and all this other. So there are many, many thematic things in the movie tied to hearts. So we thought the music should also be tied to the themes of the film. Again, we're not just working with the concept of like, what is the emotional experience? But we're like, what are the thematic things? And what are the, I mean, in a lot of ways, we're very academic about the stuff. Rather than emotional, I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, we only care about themes and not so much about characters or anything like that. So, but it's funny because like you kind of mentioned, you know, like you're a very versatile player and you can play in every style, and that has worked to our advantage because each of our films is so different. And just as filmmakers, we've tried to explore different styles. And so when we come to you and we're like, this is Magnetic, you know, we need kind of John Carpenter, kind of 80s synth stuff, or like this is Below the Trivers, now suddenly we need orchestral French horn and, you know, whatever. We can come to you and be like, this is what we want, you know, and you have enough experience and enough insanity to be like, yes,
you're like, okay, here's something sounds to do. Good.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's great. And that's the cool. I mean, I think that's, I don't know, for me, like doing this kind of work is awesome because I've always, A, wanted to do it. And B, I always think of like the music as another character. And that's why I was going to ask, with all the films that you watched, like what, you know, did scores stick out? Or, you know, to me, it's like when, you know, when you're listening to, when you're seeing a film, to me, that I do rely on listening to something. The music sucks. I can't watch the movie. You know, it affects me, you know, and it really is a turnoff, you know, for me anyway. I don't know, but.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we see a lot of movies. It'll sound like a dig on somebody specific, but it's not anybody, like nobody listening should think this is about them. We see a lot of movies where I think the composers aren't really storytellers, if that makes sense. They're people who like to make music, and they like to, you know, manipulate instrumentation and arrangements and other things, but they're not really storytellers in the sense that they don't know how to convey a dynamic narrative. They might even be able to capture the emotion. They're like, oh, this is the emotion in this moment, but you have to like really... I mean, this is what my philosophy with directing is basically you're looking at the arc. It's all about arcs. It's like, how does something change from point A to point B? And so for a feature film, you're looking at the arc of the opening scene to the end scene, but you're also looking at the arcs within a scene. Every character has an arc or a movement within a scene. So like, how do they start and how do they end the scene? Where are they emotionally? Where are they, you know, with their understanding of the world? And so I think the music plays a huge role in conveying those arcs, you know, looking at the dynamics of it. It's not just about like, oh, this is a sad scene, let's put some sad music under it. We have to understand the character's experience and change and the dynamic of that experience. And somebody like Bernard Herrmann, who's really looking at the emotional impact, I think is amazing at, you know, conveying that emotional arc. You really feel it. And, you know, part of that lecture today, they were talking about Psycho. And the end scene when he's in the asylum or whatever, and how like it doesn't resolve. It gets like really dissonant and then never resolves.
Yeah.
You're like, yeah, the movie doesn't resolve. You know, that's again tied to the thematic ideas of the movie and the actual character arc ideas of the movie. It's like he's contented within himself, or she, I don't know if it's the mother, how you convey what's exactly going on at the end of the movie. But the music like gives you a sense of that open non-resolution that's the same as what the emotion of the character is and what the narrative is as well. And so I think, you know, being able to capture that kind of thing requires not only a musical ability or an understanding of how music is structured, but an ability to understand storytelling and narrative structure and, you know, just how characters move through a narrative space.
I think, like, in the same way that people get constrained through, like, the right way to do cinematography or the right way to, like, you know, structure a story, I think some composers get trapped in, like, you know, this is a scary scene, so it's got to have this swell and then this drop and then it's got to come back in. It's got to be really manipulative and kind of, it ends up being very generic sounding, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of, like, you know, lower budget stuff too, it's just like, you know, they're just like, here, go do something. It might be very good, but it's like not interesting to me. So it's kind of rare that I notice the music in a way where I'm like, oh, wow, they went to somewhere different with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do see a lot of films with good scores. It's not, we shouldn't say that, but there is a reason why it's not just like the best musicians are the best at scoring, you know, or the best arrangers are the best at scoring. You know, there's something about that storytelling element. And I think that's been really interesting for us. And that's part of what, you know, when we came to film, we were songwriters really first. We spent a lot of time songwriting. And you have the same kind of arcs and the same kind of storytelling that happened in song and in song structure. And it really applied almost directly, I think, to starting to work on films. And I feel like that informed my ability to structure, to write films, to edit films, all that.
Yeah. Well, I think specifically for us, because we have a music background, it's always in our mind, like, you know, like we've been discussing, we have this movie kind of in post, and we've been discussing, like, what is the sound of this movie? And so we're like digging deep into, like, stuff we like and stuff of the correct time period, because we're always doing kind of time period pieces. So, you know, as opposed to, like, maybe some other types of filmmakers where it's like it might be an afterthought, for us, it's always at the forefront of what we're doing. Like, you know, this is going to be very 80s or this is going to be very giallo. You know, we like kind of pick a style to go with, and then that kind of informs everything for us. And that, you know, and the music is a huge part of that, because we care a lot about the music.
Which is great. No, but I think also, I think for me, also it's hard because, I mean, I've, you know, worked with you guys in so many different ways, but I think doing the film stuff, especially when we started doing the film stuff, for the fact that you already have that background and then can convey, you know, not only like the musicality of it, but also like the, you know, the story arc and what you're feeling for different things. It's a different, I think, dynamic than if you had no idea what music was. Right. And where it was coming from. It's because a lot of people, it's like, it's, and this is what, and I'm going to say, this is not a statement from anybody's perspective at all, but it's like for the, you know, some people that say, you know, I don't have a background in music, so I don't know what would work. And it's like, kind of like, I would say that because I'm not really a visual person. I'd be like, I don't know, yeah, sure, that, like, whenever I used to have a camera and take photos, it'd be like, I would catch someone just as they were about to turn. So all my family photos are all, like, from people's butts, kind of, like, all their back. And be like, why didn't you get, like, Aunt Ray from the front? It's like, why did she turn around just at that time? So so for me, I feel like when you're working with, like, a filmmaker that's like, you know, okay, I don't know what works and what doesn't. It's like, and I always try to say, for those people, I always say, well, you know, you try to give a little bit of a sonic palette to work from that's both like an emotional palette and a sonic palette tied together. And sometimes it's difficult because you're not sure, like, what, you know, one person's like sad might be another person's like happy, you know, or one person's like, that's really disturbing, like, might be like, that really calms me down, you know, that sound with, you know, so.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's why I'm like, I feel so, I think we, you know, Sophia as well, we feel so, like, it's, music is such an important part. And often to these films, we've spent, you know, more days working on the score than we did shooting
the movie. Which we also have more time.
We do. Know, I mean, it's easier, you know, it doesn't involve as many people. There are reasons why beyond just that.
Sure. Yeah.
But you know, we do spend a lot of time really thinking through the score and working through it and trying to make sure it captures what the purpose is. It really is an important part to us. So, yeah. And you know, you have been nominated and won many awards for the for the work that we've all done together,
which is great. And I can't say how, I mean, I totally, hey, I appreciate the fact that I get to work with you guys, because it's like, it's all about people. When you're working with the people that you like and you want to work with and you appreciate what they do and they're friends, you know, I just happen to have super talented friends. So I guess I'm lucky. but that's the icing on the cake, which I'm happy to, you know, it's great. It's awesome. But, you know, even if that didn't happen, that would still be awesome, because we get to do this thing together that other people like. And hopefully to me, it's always like learning how to strip away ego. Cause you know, look, I mean, of all my bands, like, I don't want a singer. I'm going to be the star with my guitar. I don't need a voice. But in this, it's like stripping away the ego. It's not about like, you know, like if you guys are like, oh, that, you know, I don't like what you did there. I'm not going to be like, well, it has to be like this because I worked so long on it. It's not about that. It's really about, okay, so what can I change?
Is the point here.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's also like, what can I change to make sure that like whatever this point is, I didn't quite understand maybe. So tell me what needs to change to make it work.
Right.
You know?
And it's all in service of the project. I mean, that's the way I see it is, you know, even... you know, we get better over time with giving up things that we like just because we like them, because they're not in service of the project. Yeah. You know, that we have to, everything has to be really...
Well, every minute and stage of filmmaking is compromising on your ideal situation.
Yeah.
So it's like whatever's super important to me, sometimes I just have to give up and be like, all right, I just got to do what is needed in this moment. I think it's choosing that.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the projects, to shift gears a little bit, one of the cool projects that we worked on recently together is a short film called Darling Pet Monkey. And we had director Jim McDonough on a few episodes ago. And that's been playing at a bunch of festivals, including Fantasia recently. And that's a really interesting project because it came together. That movie wouldn't exist were it not for our collaborations previously.
That's right.
And so I don't know, Sophia, do you want to tell the story, or Catherine, do you want to tell the story of meeting?
Yeah, well, literally we met Catherine because a mutual friend of ours, Kelly Davidson, who also happened to shoot our first two movies, 10 and Magnetic, fantastic photographer and cinematographer. She like had a cousin in music school, I guess, and they needed to record a band that night. And they had somebody and it fell through, or Kelly was supposed to do it. And she had just reached out to Catherine and reached out to us separately. And we all just were like, okay, cool, whatever, we'll go play a song. And we all said yes, not knowing the others had said yes. And then we all just ended up in a car together. And I think like we just kind of generally sort of had heard of each other.
Yeah, I think I feel like I'd seen Axe Monkey play before.
I saw your Darling, I saw Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. I love the band.
We knew like each other in certain terms, but not like we weren't friends yet. And really ever talked, I think. And so like, and now we're in a car together driving like 50 minutes to like Lowell outside of Boston to record
That's
a song.
Right.
And we didn't know what the song was going to be. And so we started chatting about, what even is going to be the name of the band. And so we decided, you know, Michael had seen the ad from this.
Well, I was inspired. First of all, I was inspired because Catherine's band is called Axe Monkey.
Yeah.
And we were in a band called Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling.
Right.
So the first thing was, I think, thinking about
like
how to combine
Monkey.
The names.
Yeah.
And so I remembered that I had seen this ad for Darling Pet Monkey, which contained both Darling and Monkey in the name. And so I was like, hey, what if we write a song about this ad that's like, you know, a famous weird ad about buying a monkey in the mail that ran in the back of comic books in like the 60s through, I think, into the early 70s.
Crazy.
And you both foolishly said,
well, we're like, cool, whatever. I mean, it's a one-time thing at this point in our minds, right? We're like, okay, cool.
Well, yeah, and I thought, yes. But I also remember when we were in the car, I was like, what key do you like to sing in? Because I was like, they were like, she likes D. I'm like, okay, drop D. Awesome.
So. Yeah, I think we were pretty much, we got there, we were like D minor.
The best was we get there and the kids, you know, like 18-year-old kids are setting up and we're like, all right, give us like 15 minutes and we'll write the song. And they were all like looking at us like we were literally insane. And about 15 minutes later, we had the song ready to record.
That's true. It was, and it was great. It was fun.
It was fun. And we re-recorded it later because then we started this band. We're like, it's all garage rock. It's really fun. It's about the stuff sold in the back of comic books. And so we ended up writing a bunch more songs and releasing a couple records. And we played a bunch of really weird, fun shows in like Chinese restaurant basements in the middle of New Hampshire.
It was awesome. Weird shows. That was so fun. That was great. That was great.
But yeah, so that band was pretty, was, you know, I would say, I don't know, successful is a funny word, but like we had a good time.
Fun. We had a
good time
fun.
With it.
Oh, we had fun.
You know, people
yeah.
seemed to like it. And then I somehow decided like we should make a movie.
Well, all of our ideas always snowball bigger and bigger and bigger, I think. It's just like a fault of character for Michael and I. And so we're like, yeah, we got to make a movie now. And it kind of started, I think, too, is like we had shot some music videos for the for the songs. And so we have all this footage. And so we're like, let's put together a movie about these items sold in the back of comic books because it's something we haven't seen talked about before.
Yeah, and then I saw on NPR this guy Tim Tate telling the story of actually ordering a mail order monkey, and the story was insane. So I reached out to him. I said, "Hey, we're thinking about working on this movie. Would you be interested in doing an interview for it so that we could, you know, put your story in it?" And he said, "Sure." He invited us down to he was having a birthday party. That was going to be themed to his monkey story, basically. Because a lot of his life, I mean, he's an artist. He does a lot of amazing things. So it's not like the monkey is the most important thing in his life. But it's a fun, quirky story that everybody knows him for the story of buying a mail order monkey. And his friends had made a musical about it for the like DC Fringe Festival and stuff. So it's you know, it's an important part of his life in a creative way, beyond his actual real art, which is like glass blowing and amazing. He does amazing.
Oh,
glass,
it's amazing.
Glass
work. His work is amazing.
So I don't want to diminish his real work, but the monkey work is important too. So we went down. So Catherine and I and our friend Hugh Guiney flew down, shot an interview with Tim and hung out at the party and interviewed a bunch of other people there and did all kinds of stuff. And then came back and sat on this interview for like 5 years.
I think like, you know, when we were researching, you know, the various people involved in these products, first of all, they were very hard to find. And second of all, you know, they were very spread across the U.S. in a way that we're like, all right, we're going to travel to Florida and interview these people. Like, you know, just like the costs of it skyrocketed. And it so just kind of got backburnered for us as like a project where we're like, someday want to do this, but we just don't have like the resources for it. And then when Jim expressed interest in, I think we kind of pitched the idea to Jim to do something with this interview about the monkey, and he was excited to do it and then made this amazing movie. Now we're kind of rekindled this idea that like we should work on this documentary but not worry about it being a talking head doc. Just let it be like the weird music videos and like these little animated segments, and let it be very offbeat and off kilter because it definitely matches what the products were. You know, you get like the Frankenstein, you know, you order from the comic book and then it comes and it's literally a trash bag. You know, like the products are so hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
So I think now we're seeing that there's an opportunity there to do something a little bit crazier with it.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it was cool to be able to do the music with you on that. And then
it was awesome. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Right. It also used some of the original song. Yeah.
Right.
That we wrote. Yeah. We did definitely use some of the original song. And then once again, that was another opportunity for me to like say, well, there's some classical pieces that I could like, you know, kind of like rip apart and reassemble for that movie, which I did. And but then incorporating the, you know, the Darling Pet Monkey stuff that we did, some of the stuff was just absolutely perfect, you know, because especially like the circus one, you know,
right,
so
right.
It was like, but I mean, it's such a great project, such a great film too. My God.
Oh yeah, Jim knocked it out of the park big time.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, that's how our weird collaboration started. Was this
right? Just everybody in the car, like, all right, we're gonna go do this, and that's just kind of like the way our artistic life goes. It's just like shove as many people as we can into a car and just go on a weird adventure, and then somehow you're stuck with us for the rest of your life.
Great.
And you were actually on set for the filming of 10 for the
yes,
10
that
days
is true.
Of, yeah. 10 days
10
of,
days of madness. Yeah, so I got to see every aspect. I participated, right?
Yeah,
I
did. You were definitely part of it. So you've gone beyond just the composing side.
Also, I remember like we you know, for that movie, I think it was definitely everybody's learning experience on like what is a movie. You know, because we'd made like music videos and shorts before, like only a couple shorts really, but this was our first feature film and we had no idea what we're doing. And so like we rented this mansion in Rhode Island and like it was 17 of us, like the 10 people in the cast and like seven others. And I was like, nobody's allowed to leave.
Except for me.
Nobody's allowed Except to leave. For me. But Catherine had to leave every day to get food.
And coffee.
But yeah, so that was the auspicious start of this whole thing.
And that's true.
I think, you know, we've had a it's been really fun, you know, getting to work with you on all these different projects, because we see a lot of different types of things, and now we kind of know efficiently how to do certain kinds of things. And we always, the last few projects, I think we've kind of thrown to you. We're like, okay, we need this tomorrow. So yeah. I think Darling Pet Monkey and Bloodhound they're just quick turnarounds. So we didn't get to do as much, you know, iteration and collaboration as I would like.
But it's still good. Yeah, no, it is. And of course, you know, our current pandemic situation has cut down. I was planning on coming to LA like sooner rather than later. And right now that's, you know, on hold. So even like coming to work on, you know, anything, it's just like working like this is, I guess, how it has to be for a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Well, I was saying to Michael, like, you know, we're kind of on hold for two. I mean, we probably talk about this every week, but we have two features that are kind of related to each other that we've shot most of both of them. So eventually they will need score. And I was like, but Kathy, like, has to come here. To do the features,
and
so
I
much
will
easier
be
that
there.
Way.
I don't care if I have to drive my car. I will drive if I have to. I will definitely be there. I got
to
be right
sit,
now.
You might have to work outside.
Yeah, we'll quarantine
with masks
you.
On.
That's fine. No, yeah. That's fine. I got my friend who can hook me up, too.
No, well, none of this will be happening.
Yeah, well, we can't really finish the movies until the pandemic has calmed down a little bit anyway. So it's in the future, but it was just funny because I was talking about that yesterday.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's how I like to work, like with you know, like up to Blood of the Tribbers, we all lived in the same town and sometimes the same house. And so like, that was easy.
Oh, yeah.
And then with Clickbait, you flew out here and spent a week and we worked you really hard for a week and didn't let you
pretty
do
much,
much tourism.
Right?
So.
No, I got to see, like, I remember I was like, can I just see a little bit? Like, can we go to Griffith Park for 5 minutes? Can we, I mean.
We're like, dude, finish 5 minutes of score. And
I
then
wanted
you can...
to go to Disney, but.
It was tough,
here's your keyboard. Okay.
Get to work. Get busy.
Yeah.
No, but it's been a really fun collaboration. And we actually have a record that, so all of the scores to the feature films are available on Spotify and various other platforms. They are mostly under the name Night Kisses. That's kind of been our weird offbeat collaborative scoring name. Some of them, I think 10 is actually just under your name, Catherine Capozzi.
Yeah.
But we actually have a compilation of like odds and ends that we've been.
Did that actually come out yet?
It's out.
Yeah, nice.
It's called Launch Over Film Scores Volume 1 or something very generic that I can't remember the name of.
Yeah.
But it's by Night Kisses essentially, and it has our names on it
as
well.
There's a lot of the short films. And
Yep. It includes Shiny Diamonds, Darling Pet Monkey, a number of like little one-off scores.
Half-cocked
is on it. Yeah. So
Leopard. Leopard
is on it.
Dial Tone of Doom.
Yeah. So a bunch of films that we've worked on together all kind of compiled. These are like the odds and ends of score that we had sitting around that didn't quite merit a full, you know, album release, but we want to get out in the world. So that is out now. It's on Bandcamp and it'll be on Spotify and such any day now.
Yeah.
So you should be able to listen to it soon. Yeah. So that's exciting. And otherwise, some of the films we're working on are at festivals. So Shiny Diamonds is currently at Nightstream. Darling Pet Monkey's playing a whole slew of fests. I can't think of what it is this week, but there's
so many.
A bunch coming up. We'll link to it if you go to our blog. You can check that out.
Yeah.
We've got Half Cocked at a couple of fests still. Vancouver Horror Show coming up. And it's just about wrapping up its festival run at this point. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be released in some form. Yeah. Please. And you can watch Clickbait and Magnetic and Blood of the Tribbids and 10. Those are all available through various streaming
platforms.
And or physical outlets right now. Is there anything else that you're working on that you want to talk about? Not now with us. I mean, since we've kind of exhausted all that.
Guess I can start mentioning this. I was picked by director Rachel Talalay to work on a film that was by her and well, it's her daughter's film called The Introvert's Guide to High School. So I know that's starting to make the film circuit now. So that's kind of cool. That's a fun release. And I was doing some trailers for Vanessa Iona Wright for the Western, like Golden Tooth. So I did trailers for that. Of course, that movie's on hold right now until COVID is over with. And then I did the sympathy card for Brendan Boogie. But other than that, we have, the Bring Us Your Women multimedia extravaganza, which we were
about Bring Us Your Women, the major project.
No, that's huge. Mythology, women, religion, all the things you're not supposed to talk about at the dinner table with your family, all happening. So that's the big project. So we just recorded three songs, Medusa, which is Sophia wrote.
Yeah, I'm excited for that to come out.
It's a cool film. And then Christina Goh did Hypatia and Lezu, which will be also part of this very small release. But it's a cool project that I would like to just keep going, even if it's just virtually, because I think it's important to have these stories be told in as many different ways as possible.
And Bring Us Your Women, I mean, there were a couple of concert performances. I think one of them is available online to watch.
Yeah, actually, the last one we did is actually available on YouTube, on the Bring Us Your Women YouTube channel.
Right.
And it's a full performance of what we did in March of, 2019, right? 2019, yes.
Was it only last year? Wow.
Yeah, I think it was.
Oh my God, it seems like it's been 5 years ago. It does.
We also work with you for the initial run of the initial couple of performances of Bring Us Your Women. We produced with you a series of music videos made by a number of different filmmakers. And that whole film is available online for watching, and it's on a number of different film outlets. You can check that out. It's just a film called Bring Us Your Women. And I think we the whole thing is on YouTube now, even. It's on Hoopla and a number of other streaming services. Yeah. But I think we ended up putting it all on YouTube so because people can check it out.
Can check it out, yeah.
A number of cool directors, including Izzy Lee, who was a guest on our show 2 weeks ago or two episodes ago. Just a whole bunch of great filmmakers from around the world.
That's the exciting part of the project. It's a global collaboration on a very poor person's budget. So it's cool, right? We can all talk together. We can all work on these. That's what I think the exciting thing about the project is, being able to bring people from different parts of the world that may not even speak the same language, but at least, you know, we can do something together. So, and this film and the launch over production of Bring Us Your Women Films is really a good example of that, because it has all the stories are told by these different iconic figures by different filmmakers, and, you know, the music videos are all kind of cool. So,
yeah. So you can check that out.
Laurel Vale asked me to do the score for What Metal Girls Are Into. And so I wrote music for my band Axe Monkey that was kind of like inspired by the film. And so there'll be like a little EP of three songs that were inspired by What Metal Girls Are Into. So it'll be Metal Monkey.
Nice.
Awesome. Yeah, that's made by our friend Laurel Vale, who we're working on a secret project with right now. Hopefully that we'll get off the ground. We'll see about that. But she's great. And What Metal Girls Are Into is available.
It's on Amazon.
On Amazon and everywhere else. And it's a great film. And you did all the music for it, and Sophia sings the closing
theme, which is kick ass.
Yeah,
it's just awesome. So yeah,
that was fun. And Laurel sent me like the transcription service had tried to transcribe the lyrics to that, because I sing it like in metal voice, and it was really funny what they thought the words were, and in some instances were maybe a little better than what I had written.
Oh really?
And so I had to send Laurel the actual lyrics, and I was like, well,
maybe you should change it to the transcriber.
It was really funny. I forget.
You have to show me that. That's
example.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really funny.
Yeah. But that was fun. So, I mean, that was a, you know, so those are some of the things. Oh, and then, in addition to all that, there's like this, the other thing that I'm working on is just like completely separate from all this. It's my guitar duo with Rafi Sofer, who it's like, it's a flamenco, which is nylon string guitars. So we get to not hide behind anything, and we have to articulate our notes and our feelings with just nylon string guitars. There's no distortion, no echo, nothing to hide behind. So if you screw up, you have to redo it. We've played, like, pandemic-wise, we've been able to perform twice, once at the Boston Public Library and once outside at Storytelling Time. So, you know, people react differently to that music than they do to any of the other projects I've been in. And it, the closest thing that I can relate it to is when I was playing in Ziaf, which was the band that did the music of Edith Piaf. So it's a different audience. It's like, I don't know, people are liking it so far. So, and it's cool, so. Cool.
So where can people, just so we can make sure to point everybody to it. First of all, your primary project is called Axe Monkey. And then you have a lot of other sort of side additional projects.
Yes.
Is there a good like website that has everything on it, or are we just...
Yes, the website that has everything as CatherineCapozzi.com.
Easy to remember.
That's easy to remember. My name with C, C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, last name Capozzi, C-A-P-O-Z-Z-I. So that's where everything is.
Well, cool. This was a really fun conversation about music and composing and filmmaking and friendship. We covered a lot.
And monkeys.
We did. And world. Did we cover world peace yet?
Yeah.
That's next week. Next week, we'll have world peace on the show.
Yeah, thanks for being on our podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, guys.